bore everybody else to death or something.
All right.
They're technical trivia. Okay. Why? You said you'd tell us later, and this is like a year and a half later. And tapes have unfailing memory.
Thing I didn't say how much later.
Did they ever figure out why the V2 landing site looks so different from the orbiter than it does from the lander? Did they ever solve that dune field problem?
You know something? Okay, to my knowledge, the answer is no, but my knowledge on Viking has all of a sudden become badly incomplete. By the way, I guess it's all right. I thought you had your tape sitting on the speaker there. The special issue of Journal of Geophysical Research on Viking, which is literally this thick.
I've got to reserve it at the library.
Okay, has come out, and the result is that I've been paralyzed in doing any interviews about Viking. Because, you know, for months, everybody that I tried to interview said, well, look, that's all in our paper. Why don't you wait till it comes out? And of course, now that it's come out, they'd say, why don't you read our paper? And they have been promising and promising and promising and promising to send me a free copy of the doggone thing and not doing it. And apparently, they're all sitting there at Langley Research Center. And Langley used to run Viking, and now JPL has taken it over completely, and that may be part of the problem. And apparently, somebody's just sitting on it. Nobody has their copies. They ordered like 2,000 reprints of the thing, and reprint just means another copy in this case. And, you know, I'm just really annoyed. I phoned just last week, the JPL Public Information Office, and I said, you know, can you guys send me a copy? And they said, we don't even have a copy of our own. The mission director has one copy.
The junior member in our club has a copy. He calls me up every
other
day.
He probably bought it.
And says, oh, it's so fantastic, you ought to see it. We'll get it back to the library, and I'll see it.
I see. Library copy, yeah. Well, you know, and so the thing is, I just don't know what's going on in Viking anymore. It really annoys me. And
well,
I hate to spend the money
Viking
on the
questions.
Thing. It's a $30 thing.
Yeah,
and, you know, I hate to spend that money if and then 3 days later get it in the mail for free, which I'm sure is the way it would happen. But in the meanwhile, I'm just out of touch with them. All my information is 6 months out of date.
Mine's probably even further than that.
Go ahead and ask your questions. I might know the answer.
Seismometer ever uncaged on V1?
No. And I believe they did officially give up on that. In fact, they tried just everything.
They just gave up on the lost cause, pushed the button every other day.
Then. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, they did all kinds of things. I mean, the hope was that it was a broken wire and that if somehow you could get the ends into contact for just a second. So they sent commands at all different times of the day when the temperature was different, so the thermal expansion, contraction, you know. They tried moving the antenna as hard as they could and sending the command simultaneously and moving the sampler arm, and, you know, just nothing worked. So they've... there's just no hope for that. But the last I heard, and again, 6 months out of date, there has not been another quake. There has been one quake. And that's it. And the entire lander.
They weren't even sure that was a quake because it was their first event.
This one's pretty definite.
Oh, they are now positive.
I'm not sure which one you're talking about because there was one they got all excited about and are now quite certain is a wind event.
Okay, that might be the one I heard of. The
probably.
One I heard of
that was the
like,
first one that was publicized.
Yeah, that was the one I heard about. It was the first one
yeah,
that said they
yeah.
only had one event. And
at the January news conference last year, they talked about that, and then it turned out that is a wind event.
Mm-hmm.
But then they got another one, which among other things looks like a quake on Earth. And that makes it a little bit,
is that
you know,
the one that was 4,000 or 5,000 miles away, they thought?
No, that was your wind
okay.
event. That was
now
supposed to be a major one, Richter magnitude 5 or thereabouts,
yeah.
several thousand miles away. This one is about 90 miles away. It is Richter magnitude 3 or thereabouts, and that's the only one they've hit. From that, they got a crustal thickness, though.
Oh,
in fact, you can take that one crustal thickness and use it to calibrate old Mariner 9 orbital data, which can be used to give you a crustal thickness for the whole planet if you've got one ground truth site. And so they've got a crustal thickness map for the entire planet with one quake.
And what is that? Doesn't that, seems to me I've heard something about that, something that the core is off-center on Mars or something like
if
that.
If so, I haven't heard it. That was that's popular with the moon a while ago.
Okay, Mars has more water vapor, though it is locked in soil, than CO2. According to Jim Loudon, a la March 77.
The assumption,
yeah.
Yes, that's
okay.
The assumption.
How does that compare to Earth, though, as far as water vapor goes?
The assumption is based on the situation on Earth.
See.
We got three times as much, we've outgassed three times as much water as carbon dioxide. All right. And, of course, on Venus, you don't have that. You know, you have very little water. And the assumption that most people make is that because Venus never had the water to begin with because it's closer to the sun. And so the dust grains that it formed out of didn't have the water. Water was not a solid in any significant quantity out there. And the assumption has been, following from that, that Mars had more water per cubic mile than Earth. And now there's been a paper in Science a few months ago which kind of cast doubt on that, but I think it makes so many assumptions that, you know, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. But I haven't read the paper very carefully either, so I may just be showing my ignorance there.
Has the single scan mode of lander cameras detected any forms of movement?
As of the last time I heard, no. They have detected one change, and that is a little slump right at the foot of Big Joe, the big boulder at the lander one site. And you look at these pictures. No, what's happened is just a little tongue of soil about 18 inches long has slid about 2 feet downhill and uncovered some dark stuff, probably just part of the rock underneath. That's the only thing that's ever happened, and they don't know what caused it.
And did they ever see Phobos and Deimos from the lander?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Okay, I never saw any.
Yeah, you missed my Phobos and Deimos lecture.
I know.
And that would have given you all that. I don't know. There are no plans for me to... Well, as a matter of fact, I don't know. I suggested to Lee that if I give... The likelihood is that I will give a lecture here in September and then split for California and so forth. Or at least, is that still the likelihood? Okay. One thing I suggested was that I make it the Moons of Mars lecture because they were looking for something that the geology department would be interested in supporting and so forth. And so you might get it yet.
Okay. This is the corporate question.
All right.
It's a long question. Probably got a one-word answer.
Okay.
NASA's budget...
Unfortunately, this word is not available owing to difficulties with the postal authorities at the present time.
NASA's budget is a skeleton of what it used to be, and this week they were told to cut 500 federal employees, federally granted employees.
NASA was told
that? Yes, they were told they had to cut off 500 more. I think they've only got 500 left or something like that, but anyway... you've seen three possible Skylab missions canned, a lunar polar orbiter canned, the Grand Tour cut down, the follow-up Mars mission has been ignored virtually, and now the space colony is going down the tube, and then possibly the Jupiter
probe. Oh, not necessarily.
We have no sentiment in Congress really.
Yeah, you do.
Money.
Oh,
really?
You do. You do.
Majority sentiment?
Let's say majority apathy and no... terribly large amount of strong opposition.
And
you have
one...
Oh, yeah, I mean, you know, there's Proxmire and there's Boland and there are a couple of others. But they, well, you know, even their own committees have regularly overridden both Proxmire and, at least in the case of Galileo, as Jupiter Orbiter Probe is now officially called, they overrode that and in the committee, you know, and... Well, let's take another example. The Senate has an energy committee of some sort, you know, future energy prospects and that kind of thing. And they took testimony from O'Neill and a whole bunch of other people, including NASA people and Department of Energy people, on the space colonization, space-generated solar option. And Frank Press, the president's science advisor, was one of the people that testified, and he said, you know, it's there's no reason to think it's a good idea. There are no economic studies that show they should make money out of it, which is just is either ignorance or he's lying, one or the other. And Frosch was down on it, the administrator of NASA, and so on. And boy, you should have heard, I've seen the transcript of some of it, you should have heard the kind of language that those senators used to these people who were against it. They said, it is up to Congress to set priorities, not you. You are the administrative branch. You're to do what we tell you. They said, you're short-sighted. They said, why haven't you read the studies? You know, all kinds of stuff like that. Really rude things they said.
Well, that's not unusual.
You know, it is unusual.
Nothing
they
not.
Say rude things in polite language.
Yeah.
This time they said it in rude language. You know, and boy, I tell you, it must have been... If I were Frank Press, I'd have been pretty shook.
Well, what I wondered was, is there any potential or possibility
for private industry to do any
a lot of R&D.
On their own, or are there laws that say they can't launch a thing, the government's the only person that can launch
it? No. They can pay for it, they can launch it. Question is whether they can pay for it. God. I brought along the L5 Society on the latest political situation, and I can't find it. No, no, that's not it.
Well, I will give you.
I wanted to make an announcement about that. The management and budget wants to kill the Enterprise entirely, not reconvert it, and have only four shuttle orbiters. And that's the one that looks as though it's in the worst. Galileo looks pretty good. Money for additional money for space colonization studies looks pretty good, although it looks as though O'Neill's not going to get any of it.
Does Mondale have anything to do with the OMB decision? I know he's been an anti-shuttle person in the past.
He has been in the past, yes. He was back when the shuttle was, you know, fighting for money. Tom Heppenheimer claimed that Mondale has seen the light and been converted. Now, I don't know if Tom knows what he's talking about.
Born again space freak?
Yes.
I don't know. Sedimentary formation of ignium.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of granite.
Possible, yeah.
I'll probably ask you later to explain the two formations of granite because I don't think I got those down as well as I might. But anyway, you once mentioned that there was sedimentary rock on the Earth piled as high as 20 miles deep. And I was going to ask you, where, since the highest mountain we have is only 7 miles, does this mean the broader the landscape, the
No, what I would have meant by that is there are cases where it's been piled up to a total depth of 20 miles and, you know, you kept eroding as you went.
Uh-huh.
But that the total, you know, add together the thickness of various sequences in a given region, say the Colorado Plateau, and consider what was eroded away and so forth, and you can get like 20 miles. I'm not aware of any. No, there can't be any places where
it would deform from its own weight.
Well, no, not if most of it was under sea level. But, I mean, yes, of course it would, but I mean, I couldn't picture that much thickness.
Okay. That really confused
me.
Yeah.
Right. If that's what I said, it was a very poor choice of words. By the way, Sunday, you know, is coming up on May 3rd. You don't know about Sunday? Sunday, not Sunday. Sunday, okay.
That's pretty good since Friday's May 5th.
It's a national attempt to popularize the idea that solar power is a good thing and that we already have a lot of technology for it, which is good. But it looks as though they're going to have a pretty much anti-high technology bias, not in the sense that they'll speak out against it, they'll just ignore it, which means that this is an excellent opportunity for letters to the editor, to newspapers and so forth about, you know, hey, all they said was great, but this is relatively small scale, relatively near term, that's important, but in addition, you know, by 1995 we could have, et cetera, et cetera. You got to remember, space colonization is about solar power, among other things. You know, so this is a good way to get onto that particular bandwagon.
Probably have to get out the solar filters and everything for that day and set up in a shopping center or something.
That's a good idea. Yeah.
We had set up our scopes out in front of the Midland Community Center last week.
Uh-huh.
And it was a free choice night. It turned out there were two events at the community center and the Shriners Convention at the same time. We had 75 people.
Where do you go? Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
Good evening. I'd like to welcome you all again to the next in our series of lectures by Jim Loudon. He tells me that, he doesn't know he's told me this, he tells me the title he picked for tonight's talk has nothing to do with the inhabitants of the world he's going to talk about, but I'm not sure. In any case, Earth, the weirdest planet of all, part one, continental drift, lecturer Jim Loudon, commentator on space and astronomy for National Public Radio, very excellent speaker, and I expect to learn a lot about the Earth.
Thank you very much.
Do you have a microphone, sir? Microphone?
With you in a minute. That somebody could work out a microphone cord which would be easily understandable. I have no idea how this thing fastens. Let's clip it and hope that it...
No, it's not going to work.
There's no fastener as far as I can see. All right, that'll do it. Okay, well, don't worry about it. That'll fasten up. As I was saying when I so rudely interrupted myself. Hi, and thank you very much. This, I take it, is the hardcore. This is about a third of the audience we had last time. But that's okay. The Earth, in fact, is the weirdest planet of all in many respects. I suppose, in a way, that title is kind of a hype because you could make out the argument that any of them is the weirdest planet of all. One of the things that I've been impressed with as we have gone out into the solar system, studied the planets close up, and found out what they're really like instead of what we thought they were like, is the way that every one of them insists on being a unique individual all to itself. It's just incredible. There is no two that are alike. Even the two little bitty moons of Mars, Phobos and Deimos, which you'd think would be so small and therefore be so restricted in the number of things that could happen to them, geologic history, you'd think at least they would be identical. Even they turn out to be quite different from one another in a number of respects in the Viking orbiter close-up observations. So, really, what we seem to have is of the 16 major worlds in the solar system, and there are 16, you know, not just the 9 planets, there are also a number of major moons out there, some of which are actually bigger than some of the planets, so it's not fair not to count them too. And really, you seem to have 16 classes of world, each represented by one individual. I think that has very important implications far beyond the matter of our own solar system. Astronomers, including some far more eminent than I, and deservedly so, have tended, in this past several decades anyway, to assume that Earth-type planets and Earth-type life must be very common throughout the universe, simply because we got burned a few times in the history of astronomy by assuming there was something unique about us. Astronomers are therefore very reluctant to do this again. And I really wonder, I mean, after all, getting burned a couple of times does not constitute a natural law, and I really wonder how common any particular type of planet, including Earth-type, really is. I'm not saying that I don't think that Earth-type planets are common or that Earth-type life doesn't exist elsewhere in the universe. I'm saying that we are so ignorant at this stage in our knowledge that we just don't know even enough to put a probability on it. And this is one respect in which I disagree with a person who, in general, I very much admire, Carl Sagan. By the way, if you haven't heard the word, Carl Sagan, you know, we have the feeling he's one of us, one of our boys. Last week won the Pulitzer Prize for The Dragons of Eden. So that is something which I think is very nice. I could wish that it were for one of his space books, but after all, we can't have everything. And there isn't space material in there. Dragons of Eden is also out in paperback, for those of you that are Carl Sagan fans and have been, like myself, waiting until the first one you could afford came out. This is a respect in which I disagree with Carl Sagan. He has a tendency to be one of these people that just go around saying intelligent life must be very common. And I just don't think that at this stage in our knowledge of the universe we can say. What this means, what the variety among the planets means, is that planetary exploration is just more and more exciting. Every new world has all kinds of new surprises for you, and it's fascinating to go out there and see what they're going to turn out to be this time. The Earth, of course, has been the planet that we have been able to study close up for a long time, but the problem with that has been that in many cases, even though we could study it, we didn't have the capability of comparing it with other worlds, and often we didn't know which of the things that we knew about it were the really significant facts and which were more or less accidental. And so we have been getting new insights into our own planet by going out and studying other planets. In particular, the thing that I'm going to talk about tonight, which in fact is not continental drift, that's another hype, and I'll get to that in a moment. The thing that I'm going to talk about tonight includes continental drift. Don't worry, you'll get your money back if you're not satisfied. Double effect. But the question is whether plate tectonics, which is what I'm really going to talk about, and is the modern extension of the old idea of continental drift, it includes much more than just the continents themselves moving, whether this happens on any other planet. It's an exceedingly important question because we have found out in about the last 12 years that the thing that I'm going to talk about tonight, plate tectonics, is the dominant process in the geology of our own world. And for the first time in history, as the posters say, we know where mountains come from, we know why there are earthquakes, we understand at least some of our volcanic processes. I think you can see that in hard dollars and cents terms, quite aside from the academic thrill of learning all these fascinating things, that it is very, very important to understand about such processes. 2 years ago in China, one single earthquake killed all by itself more people than the United States lost in the entire history of the Vietnam War. And the same thing happened independently again in Peru a few years earlier than that, and so on and so forth. Few people, in fact, have any notion of how active our planet is. On the average, of course, they happen randomly through time, but on the average, there is a major earthquake somewhere on this planet every 3 weeks. On the average, there is a major volcanic eruption every 2 weeks. There is a landslide big enough to cause changes detectable from orbit every 3 weeks. There are several dozen tropical storms called by different names in different parts of the world, hurricanes, cyclones, willy-willies, that's Australia, and so on. Several dozen of those every year. I would not blame hypothetical observers on some other planet in our solar system who had observed the Earth only from a distance, say from flyby spacecraft or through telescopes, for concluding there couldn't possibly be life here because the place is simply too active and life would be destroyed if it had a chance to develop. It's remarkable, and a good deal of the geological parts of the activity, I can't blame hurricanes on plate tectonics, but a good deal of the geological part of this activity is in fact, it turns out, due to this remarkable phenomenon discovered only in the last decade plus a little bit more, which is called plate tectonics. Earth is remarkable in another respect too. We are the only planet in the solar system where there are large quantities of liquid water. Usually, water is either absent or virtually so, as on Venus and the Moon, in the frozen state, as it is on Mars for the most part, although there have been large amounts of liquid water by the standards of somebody who got caught in the flood, say, but very small amounts of liquid water as compared to, say, an ocean on Earth on Mars in the past. But in general, that planet, it's certainly never been covered by oceans the way that the Earth is. Or else you have water in the gaseous state, such as that is present on Venus. Liquid water is a very rare commodity, but it is also a ferociously active agent of both erosion of old features and of creation of new ones. And we stand here in Michigan on an excellent example of that fact. The bedrock in Michigan, that is the stuff that you get after you dig down through a few hundred feet of glacial material, which is what you're walking around on at the immediate top, the bedrock in Michigan is something which is exceedingly common on the Earth. 75% of the crust of the Earth is covered with it, and that is sedimentary rocks, sandstone, limestone, shale, those are the three most important, and there are some others, which are laid down on the bottom of bodies of liquid water. And that is so common that, you know, any geologist given one more chunk of sandstone is going to react with about the same enthusiasm as an entomologist discovering yet one more anthill. It's nothing at all unusual. But on any other planet, rocks of this sort would be so rare as to be literally unheard of on a planet such as the Moon, or all but unheard of on a planet such as Mars or Venus. And that gives you just one illustration. This, in fact, of how Earth is the weirdest planet of all, of how different we are from the others, this, in fact, is the reason why the Earth is not covered by meteorite craters, as is every other world, with or without an atmosphere, that we have seen, and at least the inner part of the solar system. We will find out from the Voyagers whether the same thing is true of the moons of Jupiter and of Saturn. But Mercury, large parts of Venus, we're pretty ignorant of the surface of Venus, but such areas as we know, large parts of them, the Moon, of course, and Mars, and the two moons of Mars, are all covered, or at least a large fraction of the planet is covered, by meteorite impact craters. Those must have happened on Earth, but They, in fact, have not so much been eroded away, which is the explanation that you often hear, as they've been buried by this weird phenomenon of sedimentary rocks laid down in liquid water on the Earth. That is all I'm going to say about that particular point at this moment. I just wanted to touch on it and then pass on. In fact, that's another whole lecture. That is indeed, following as a paid political advertisement, part two of my series, Earth, the Weirdest Planet of All, and that's the one that includes the geologic history of Michigan, and maybe someday I can come back and tell you about that one. But today, what I'm going to talk about is, as I say, not just continental drift, but plate tectonics, the modern extension of the idea. Let's have the first slide and the lights off, and I can illustrate what I mean by plate tectonics and why it's called that. This is, sorry about that. Incidentally, if any of you didn't know what was going on there, we'd probably pick up some new people with each lecture. We were playing for you the recording, which is carried on the two Voyager spacecraft, which will leave the solar system after they fly past Jupiter and Saturn, in one case perhaps Uranus. They will leave the solar system in the unlikely, but you cannot say inconceivable, event that someday some beings far out there, perhaps millions, even billions of years from now, should stumble across these 12-foot spacecraft in the trillions of miles vastness of interstellar space. There is on each one of them a two-hour recording, Sounds of Earth, to identify us to them and tell them some things about it. There are also pictures that are on it, 115 of them. If any of you are interested in those pictures, I'm going to give a lecture about those in Ann Arbor later in the summer. I do not have that copies of that particular schedule this time. I gave out some last time. We're out at the moment. I expect to have some 2 weeks from now, and you'll be able to come back and hear about those. So here was the last of the things that you heard there. The two-hour recording ends the same way as it began, that is, with the cavatina from Beethoven's 13th string quartet. It began with just a little snatch of that, and then the voice section, the non-musical section, and here it ends with the entire movement almost 2 hours later. Well, I want to begin by pointing out to you that the crust of the Earth, well, I guess I should begin by pointing out to you that the Earth is divided into a number of layers, more or less like the skins of an onion. And the reason for that is that Earth, and indeed all of the planets, all of the bodies in the inner solar system, with the exception of Phobos and Deimos, early in their histories or even during their formations, melted completely. And this is an extremely important fact, a very basic fact about all of them. Among other things, it drove off whatever atmospheres they may have had at that time. And so the atmospheres you see on some of these bodies now are of secondary origin. They're material that came out later, slowly, through outgassing, which is a general geologic term for any kind of gas coming out of the ground in volcanic eruptions, in geysers, fumaroles, hot springs, and so forth and so on. They're not materials left over primordially, unchanged from the beginning of the solar system's history. In addition, all of these bodies, as soon as they became liquid, behaved the way any mixture of liquids will, and of course, there probably were many different materials all mixed together indiscriminately in each one of these objects, because they came together presumably starting out as small grains of dust in a cloud of gas and dust that gave birth to the sun, that gave birth to the solar system. The liquid separated out in the same way as cream will separate out from milk in a gravitational field. And that is to say, the heaviest stuff falls to the bottom, and then the lightest stuff floats to the top, and all of the other materials arrange themselves in decreasing order of density as you go out from the center. And so then when the whole thing cools, what you get is a structure of different layers, like the shells of an onion, made of different materials, with the lightest stuff as a sort of scum or froth that floats up to the top, and that is what we are walking around here, and that is what we call the crust of the Earth. So the heaviest material fell to the bottom. That is the core of the Earth. That is not made of rock. It's made of iron and probably nickel and perhaps an admixture of other things. A big argument about whether there's a lot of sulfur in there. But heavy materials which fell to the bottom, most of the iron on the Earth is there in that core, 1,800 miles below your feet. And that core is the size of the planet Mars. It's a ball bearing the size of Mars, except that most of it is molten. So a drop of the outer half of it anyway is a drop of liquid iron, inner half is solid again. Then you have the heaviest rocks, and then less heavy rocks, and so on, until finally you get up to this layer that we live on that is called the crust. Now, that word crust dates back to a time in the history of geology when geologists believed that only that outer part was solid and the whole rest of the inside of the Earth was liquid. In fact, many of you may still believe this, because the word that's not so seems not to have gotten around very much. But in fact, we've known for many decades that it is not so. The Earth is mostly solid on the inside, but solid in a rather strange way. That is, it is just below the temperature at which it would melt. And in fact, the parts that literally are molten, that's the outer part of the core, are just above the temperature at which they would melt. So the really remarkable fact about the way the temperatures go in the interior of the Earth is that at any given depth, of course, the melting temperature is different, because the melting temperature goes up as the pressure goes up, and the pressure goes up as you go down into the Earth, because the weight of the overlying material keeps getting greater and greater as you go farther and farther down. So you can go down, say, 100 miles and find material that is so hot that if it were up at the surface, it would be molten. However, it is not up at the surface. It's under pressure down there, and it's just barely solid as a result of that pressure. Then go down 200 miles, you find material that would be molten if it were up at 100 miles, let alone if it were up on the surface, but the pressure is just enough greater that it is just barely constrained to be solid, and so on down. And remarkably enough, it's got to be coincidence, no other planet seems to have this kind of internal structure, but remarkably enough, as you go down inside the Earth, the curve of where the melting temperature would be as a function of depth is just below the actual temperatures. The actual temperature curve is just below the melting temperature curve until you get to the outer core, and then it's just above it, and so the material is just barely molten, and then you go down a little bit further, halfway from the top of the core to the center of the Earth, and you find that it crosses the borderline again, and so the inner core is forced into being solid as a result of the pressure. Well, what this means, as far as the material just under the crust is concerned, that's called the mantle. In fact, the mantle of the Earth is most of the Earth. It's 80% of the volume of the Earth and 2/3 of the weight of the Earth. So if you're not familiar with the Earth's mantle, you're not familiar with most of the planet. Of course, you're not very familiar with it, because we don't get material from it up here on the surface. Or if we do, we get very tiny amounts of material from it up here on the surface through volcanic processes and that sort of thing, and even that modifies it severely. What we walk around on is this thin crust on the outside, which is quite atypical as the Earth as a whole goes, even though we in our surface chauvinism tend to think of it as being important and being significant. If you made a scale model of the Earth the size of an apple, the crust of the Earth would be thinner than the skin of a real apple. So you see, you're talking about a very, very tiny fraction of it. And to give you an idea of how much we still have to learn about our own planet, we have never so much as drilled a hole from the top of the crust to the bottom of the crust. There was, in fact, a project to do exactly that a number of years ago, and it was killed by budget cutters. It's not just space that has this happen to it. There are a lot of other horror stories that I can tell you as well. The bottom of the crust is referred to by seismologists after the guy who discovered it, who unfortunately happened to be Serbian, and so instead of a nice simple name like Jones or Smith, he was named Mohorovicic. And so it is the Mohorovicic discontinuity, which is the name for the bottom of the crust, and for reasons you will have no trouble understanding, that is universally referred to as the Moho. So the project to drill down through the crust and get some direct samples of the upper mantle was naturally referred to as the Mohole, and that may have been what killed it right there. Okay, the crust is solid. And then under that, you have a thin layer, a few tens of miles thick, very thin compared to the enormous depth, though, the 1,800-mile depth all the way down through the thickness of the mantle, where you have mantle material, which is rigid. These two layers together, the crust itself and the uppermost part of the mantle, the only part that is rigid, that is really solid, is referred to as the lithosphere. This diagram is confusing. It looks as though the lithosphere is the name for the part of the mantle that's under the crust. Actually, lithosphere refers to both the crust and that uppermost part of the mantle. And then under that, all the way to the center of the Earth, you have a region where the material is almost, not quite, but almost molten, which means that although it is solid, it's mushy. It has very, very little strength, and it can act almost as a liquid. It can act as a lubricant when you're dealing with large amounts of rock, things the size of continents or even somewhat smaller, that could move around on top of it. That is referred to as plastic. Now, when we say the asthenosphere is plastic, we do not mean it's made of polystyrene. Well, that is an adjective, not a noun. It means that it is almost molten, but not quite, and so it has very little strength. Got a question over here. The question is, would that be like mud? When you start dealing with quantities of rock in this large amount, your intuition that is based on dealing with rock in much smaller quantities really does not help you very much. There are ways in which it would be like mud, but if I said that it would and then left it at that, it would be very confusing. It would be very misleading. You've simply never dealt with anything like this because you've never dealt with rock in quantities of hundreds of miles at a time. Even the, quote, rigid lithosphere is made of material which, when you get up into that kind of size, is so deformable that you might as well consider that it has no strength at all. Suppose, for example, that you tried to quarry out the state of Michigan with some sort of giant machine that could dig out the entire lower peninsula, and you fasten four giant eyeballs at each of the corners and try to haul it up in the air. You would find that the rock would be so low in strength that it would be like trying to haul an equal quantity of water up out of the ocean. No matter how high you pulled the four corners, the center would simply slump down as though it were, well, not even silly putty, because that's much stronger than rock is in that kind of quantity. So in that respect, it acts like a liquid, but obviously in smaller amounts, it does not. The reason for this is that what holds a solid together is bonds between the atoms. The nature of these bonds, we don't have to go into here, they're electrostatic attractions is what they are. Bonds between the atoms, which are exceedingly strong when you're talking about the attraction from atom number one to atom number two that is right next to it. But atom number one has very, very little attraction for atom number three, the next one over, and essentially none for atom number four, let alone atom number 5 billion, which is still, by human standards, a microscopic distance away from it. And so it's like the old bit about the house that was so decrepit that all that held together was the termites holding hands. They may be holding hands very, very strongly, each to its neighbor, but there's no bond beyond that. And if one pair of termites, let's go, it's all over, see? Okay, similar sort of thing here. Suppose you take a slab of rock and, you know, you try to quarry it up that way and it begins to bend. Of course, it's going to try to bend. And each bend between one atom and its neighbor is some ridiculously tiny fraction of a degree. Add that up over the enormous number of atoms that you have in a linear distance of 100 miles, and you will find that bend has become any angle that you want. See? So that seemed like such a simple question. In fact, I can't answer it. There is no common everyday experience that you've had which is like dealing with the lithosphere in large amounts, let alone dealing with the asthenosphere. All I can do is tell you how it operates and let it go with that. And geologists are surprised by that kind of thing, too. And in fact, there was a lot of resistance to the notion of continental drift, as it was originally called, for just that reason. Geologists just couldn't believe that you could really have a situation where continents were moving around over the surface of the Earth. What could possibly keep them going? You know, and part of the reason for that was the failure to understand that when you are dealing with that kind of quantity, you can assume that the asthenosphere especially has almost zero structural strength. When you get down to a smaller quantity, something like miles in size, then all of a sudden you begin to discover the details, and you discover that on that kind of scale, the motion occurs in series of jerks, which to people at that size scale are very important. Those are earthquakes. All right? So, long answer to what seemed like a simple question, but it introduces you to some of the difficulty of this whole thing. All right, the crust, so-called, is divided into two major types of rock, which occur in large blocks here and there. There are blocks which are called the continents, and their very edges tend to be buried by water, and so the continents really are a bit bigger than you think when you look at a map. You've really got to include the continental shelves, the edges that are buried by the water as well. Those are made of a rock. Well, then the rest of it is the low areas, and since those are low areas, they fill in with water. If the water were shown, it would be up there. And so those are referred to as oceanic crust, and this stuff is referred to as the continents. The continents are made of rock which is lighter in density than the rock that forms the floors of the oceans. That lighter rock is granite, and the heavier rock, which forms the floors of the oceans, is basalt. Since the granite is less dense than the basalt, it literally floats above it. And you see, you couldn't have picked a better time to answer that question, because I was just about to go through this whole spiel anyway. You can see how rock can float in rock in the same way, when you remember, when you're dealing with large quantities of it, you can assume they're liquids. And so they're simply going to rise and fall as though they were liquids passing through one another. The continents float above the ocean bottom rock in the same way and for the same reason as a cake of ivory soap floats in the bathtub. because it is lighter in density and therefore rides higher. So this is the structure of the outside of the Earth. Now, let's go to a map of the Earth which shows about plate tectonics. Anybody who looks at a map like this, ignore all this stuff for the time being, and simply look at the familiar continents which you learned in fourth grade, anybody who looks at a map like this is struck by the fact that the two edges of the Atlantic Ocean fit together almost like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. And in fact, that was first noticed by Roger Bacon back in the 1600s, as soon as the first maps of the New World, as they called it then, became available. And so he was the first person in history to make the suggestion that maybe once upon a time they had fitted together like parts of a jigsaw puzzle, that maybe the bulge of South America there fit into the Bight of Ben and over there in Africa and so on, and that somehow they had been torn apart and they moved away. And that was the birth of the notion of continental drift. In its modern form, continental drift is due to, and this is around 1910, 1915 in there, due to a guy named Alfred Wegener. And he was a German meteorologist, not a geologist, interestingly enough. Probably the reason he came up with the idea, because the geologists knew too much, and they never would have entertained such a notion. He knew just enough geology as an amateur interest to be able to put the idea forth and not be dismissed right away as a crank, but not enough to see what all the other geologists considered were insuperable difficulties about it. And the difficulty simply was his notion and Roger Bacon's notion and everybody's notion was up to about 1965 was continental drift and nothing but. And the idea was the continents were literally moving around over the surface of the Earth and plowing their way through the basalt of the ocean bottom. And geologists said, how could that happen? Although, okay, maybe the basalt acts like a liquid over a large quantity, over small quantities, fact remains along the front where one rock is trying to plow through another, you have to add up all the effects of the small quantities, and it just seemed impossible that there could be enough energy to move something the size of a continent through the resistance of solid rock that it was trying to plow through. And that is why this notion, although it was duly presented in every, it wasn't suppressed, it wasn't ignored, it wasn't forgotten, it was duly presented in every elementary geology textbook all through that period between Wegener's papers and around 1965 when plate tectonics came in. It was presented, of course, with the note that most people didn't believe it, but it was presented, and you can't claim the geologists were trying to suppress it or were trying to ignore it. But through all that time, people had this idea that it was continents that were drifting and that this was impossible, and so the idea of continental drift was usually abandoned. There were a few geologists always that liked it, but not very many. I can't emphasize too much that intuition was absolutely correct. As far as we know, continents cannot plow through solid rock that way. Where the big conceptual breakthrough came was when geologists finally realized that three-quarters of the surface of the Earth they had been ignoring, the bottoms of the oceans. And ironically, the key to understanding the continents turned out to be understanding the bottoms of the oceans, in just the way as we are finding the key to understanding many aspects of the Earth is going to other planets and studying them. Finally, the geophysicists began to study the bottoms of the oceans, and they discovered to their amazement that not just continents were in fact moving, but the bottoms of the oceans were divided into large chunks which were moving also. In fact, it is that motion, which is called seafloor spreading, that is important. The continents are not drifting, they are riding as passive passengers on these rafts of seafloor material, which are moving around and are carrying the continents around with them. In just the same way as you might have a piece of wood underneath the bottom of, you know, weighted down so it's just under the surface, and a cake of ivory soap which was riding along on it, and you didn't realize if you look above the surface that it's not the soap that is providing the motive power, it is whatever is pushing the wood. Here is what is actually happening. The Earth's surface is divided into a number of large units. There are about a dozen big ones, and there are a bunch of small ones, not all of which are shown on this map. Those are referred to as plates. In a typical case, a plate, well, let's take the one that we're on as a typical example, the American plate or the North American plate, depending on whether there is or is not a crack in it right there, a division between them. They're still arguing about that. If there is a crack, it's not a well-defined one.
This plate consists of the entire continent of North America, with the exception of one little slug of it down there, Southern California and Baja California, plus the entire western half of the Atlantic Ocean. So a plate is... plate vertically consists of a chunk of lithosphere. That is to say, there is some continental crust and or some oceanic crust on top, and then underneath you've got some portion of the upper mantle, a few tens of miles of upper mantle. They are moving because they are sliding over the slippery, lubricating asthenosphere underneath. We do not know still what is causing the motion, what's pushing them. But the evidence, which I'll show you a bit later on, I'll tell you the idea first and then fill in the evidence after you know what the evidence is supposed to be for, which of course is a bad way to proceed in science, but it's probably a good way to proceed for a public lecture. The evidence for it is that these plates are moving over the asthenosphere. The evidence is quite strong in this direction. Typically, there is one edge. In our case, it is the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, that huge ocean system which stretches all the way through the center of the Atlantic Ocean, and is in fact one of the largest, ocean system and the mountain system, that is bigger than any of the mountain ranges that are on the continents themselves. That is a place away from which plates are moving. You can see that our plate is moving westward away from it. That's what that arrow indicates. The South American plate, if it is separate, is also moving westward away from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and it's moving at practically the same speed, and that's why it's hard to tell whether there are, in fact, two plates there or one. If they're both moving at the same rate, there's nothing obvious happening along the boundary. But if they're not moving at the same rate, well, what's going to happen, it's easier to tell you about the South American plate now, and so I'm going to switch to that. Our western edge is a little bit more complicated, and I'll come back to it. What's happening inside of the South American plate is a very simple thing. It is being pushed over a plate which is made entirely of basaltic material, entirely of ocean bottom. There's no continental crust on it whatsoever. It's referred to as the Nazca plate. And since the plates are moving around, if there are places where plates are moving away from, the total surface of the Earth is not getting bigger, and so there must be places where other plates are being shoved down under the edges of plates that are moving towards them. There is such a place that's referred to as a subduction zone at the west edge of South America, and there the Nazca plate is being driven down underneath the edge of the onward advancing South American plate. When I say onward advancing, typical rates of motion, such as the South American plate in fact has, are about 1 inch per year. That may not sound like very much, but if you add that up over several hundred million years, 200 million to be exact, you will find that 200 million years ago, there was no Atlantic Ocean whatever, and South America was indeed touching what we now call Western Africa. 200 million years ago, most of the continental material of the Earth were assembled together into a single giant supercontinent, which is called Pangaea, from Greek words meaning all Earth. 200 million years ago, Pangaea split down the middle, and the two edges began being thrust apart from one another, and that process is still going on today. The Atlantic Ocean is about 2 inches wider this year than it was last year, if that motion is going on this particular year at the same rate as it has been over the average of the last 200 million, which is something we don't know. We don't know whether plate motion is a continuous, steady process, whether it goes in a series of jerks, whether it speeds up and slows down, because we don't know what causes it. We expect to get some experimental data on that in a few years, in fact. I'll tell you some more about that a bit later on. All right, the South American plate then is being thrust away from the Mid-Atlantic plate. The Nazca plate is diving under it. The Nazca plate, you will note, is also moving away from a so-called mid-ocean ridge, although in this case it's gotten shoved. The Pacific is getting smaller if the Atlantic is getting larger. And by now, this so-called East Pacific Rise is not in the middle of the Pacific at all. Indeed, some of it actually may disappear under the North American continent. If so, that's very controversial, but if so, it would explain certain features of the geology of the western United States very nicely, and I'll come back to that. So the Nazca plate is moving away from the East Pacific rise in this direction, coming right towards South America, and the Pacific plate, which consists of almost the entire rest of the Pacific Ocean floor, plus that one little plug of North America, which is not a part of our plate. The Pacific plate is moving westward, roughly westward, somewhat northwestward, away from the East Pacific rise. And so the Pacific is trying to expand, but the continents over there on the east edge of it are preventing it from doing so. They're rushing over it and making it slow down faster than it can expand. Question here.
Yes, that one little plug of the western U.S., is that basaltic or continental rock?
That one little plug of the western U.S., this is continental rock, this is granite. Okay, the continental rock is shown, you know, as a different color here than the ocean basin. Question there? Okay, let me try to go through these one at a time. All right, I want to come back to that one. I've got to introduce the concepts first, and then I can start taking specific questions about specific plates. In some cases, I don't know the answer. In some cases, the answer is not known. You happen to have picked one that's very controversial, so I want to come back to that later. Let's talk about the other things that can happen for any plate, and I'll show specific examples, and then, you know, when you've got the concepts, come back and show how these work out in detail. If you've got a plate which is, so far we have shown that there are two different kinds of boundaries between two plates on the map, right? There are spreading centers, spreading ridges, because it turns out that each one is a long linear ridge, like the Mid-Atlantic Ridge or the East Pacific Rise or whatever, the undersea ridge system, which began to be discovered in the early 1950s. There are these spreading ridges, and of course, if the plates are moving away from those, I got to come back and tell you what's happening there in the crack. Well, what's happening, very simply, is that new material is constantly coming up from underneath the Earth. We don't know whether that new material is coming up to fill the vacuum, so to speak, or whether it is the coming up of the new material which itself drives the plates apart. Which is the chicken and which is the egg there? Which is the cause and which is the effect? We don't know the answer to that question. But those are places where new material, new basaltic material with mantle material stuck on underneath, is being generated, is coming up from out of the asthenosphere and coming up onto the surface and being modified as it does so, so that by the time it gets there, it is not asthenosphere kind of material, it's not mantle kind of material, but it is this rock basalt. Those are the spreading ridges. Another kind of plate boundary is where one plate is being thrust down under another plate, which is moving over it, and that is called a subduction zone. Subduction zones are shown on this map by this toothed heavy line, the cold front symbol that you may be used to from weather maps, and the direction in which the arrows point on each of these lines is the direction in which the plate that is being subducted is going down. All right? It goes down at an angle underneath the plate that is being thrust over it. And there is another kind of plate boundary, obviously, and that is a plate boundary where two plates are simply being thrust past one another, and so they're moving past one another, and that plate is neither moving away or moving toward the other plate on the other side, and so nothing is changing as far as size goes. That is called a strike-slip fault. And an example, the best-known example of a strike-slip fault, is happening over here in the west. This is not a pure strike-slip fault. There's a little bit of overthrusting motion there. But to a first approximation, you can say the Pacific plate, that little slug of it that is Southern California and the Baja California, is being shoved up along the west edge of the rest of North America. The boundary between them, you would not be surprised to learn, I suspect, even if it wasn't shown there on the map, is the famous San Andreas Fault. Now, while on a large scale it is possible for these plates to move past one another, on a small scale you've got to consider that this is rock being jammed along against rock. And it has strength on a small scale. It fights back. And so what happens is not just a smooth, well-lubricated motion at all. What happens is the pressure builds up and builds up, and the two pieces of rock, the two edges on either side, hold together until finally there is not enough. They can't hold together. There's just too much accumulated stress that's built up, and they let go, spong, and that is an earthquake. And that is what is causing these earthquakes along the San Andreas Fault. A few hundred million years ago, Baja California was all the way down there against the edge of Mexico. It has moved at least several hundred miles in the last couple of hundred million years. It is continuing to move, and presumably, if this motion keeps up, And we don't know if it will. These motions you're seeing now are the present state of geologic history. There have been other motions in the past. There have been cases where there used to be either spreading centers or subduction zones where the motion stopped, and so those boundaries then became inactive. Sometimes you find those in the middle of present-day continents or the middle of present-day oceans. There are also cases where new ones suddenly opened up. I already gave you an example of that, where Pangaea, which was stable down its middle, all of a sudden began to develop a spreading ridge 200 million years ago and began to move apart where there had not been spreading before. But if this continues, presumably this slug is going to continue right on up across the edge of North America until it finally hits up there in Alaska somewhere. And how it will interact with the subduction zone, I don't want to talk about quite yet. Question here. The speed of motion, I don't remember the exact number, but it's of the order of an inch or so a year. The fastest plate motion that we know of is one that is not happening, the tail end of it is still happening, and that is India, which used to be a separate continent, and in fact, only 50 million years ago was down there against the eastern edge of Africa. It broke off 50 million years ago, and all the geometry was just right. The shape of that particular plate happened to be just perfect for the motion to occur with minimum friction. And so India has gone zipping on up through the Indian Ocean at the tremendous rate of 10 inches per year, and that's the record, and then starting about 20 million years ago, it slammed into the south edge of Africa, of Asia, and it is still trying to push its way up into Asia, but it's finding it can't get any further. Here is the reason why. Now that you know about the three types of plate boundaries, let me remind you that there are two types of rock, either one of which could be present at any one, on either side, of any one of those three types of boundaries. And you are going to have different kinds of interactions depending on how that combination works out. The magic rule, the thing to remember, so that if you remember this, then all the others make sense, all the rules make sense for all the different possible combinations, is this. Basalt is heavy. Granite is light. Basaltic plate edges can be shoved down underneath the edge of either a continental plate or a basaltic plate. So a basaltic plate can be subducted underneath either other kind of plate. But a continental edge cannot be subducted under either another continent or, of course, under an ocean plate edge. So when two continents come together, when a continent comes against an oceanic plate, of course all it does is thrust over, it's the oceanic plate always that gets subducted. Look at the map and you'll see that. There are no examples of continental plates being subducted under oceanic plates. Impossible. That'd be the light stuff being pushed down under the heavy stuff, and it's not possible. It would literally bob to the top if you tried it. But in a case where a continental edge is moving into another continental edge, since the rock cannot go down, there's only one other direction that it can go, and that's up. The edges of the two plates are crumpled up into the air, and that is the origin of a mountain range. That is the origin of the Himalayas. The Himalayas are still being formed because India is still bullheadedly trying to ram its way up into Asia, and it simply hasn't yet got the message that it's not going to be allowed to go any further. And so the Himalayas are still rising upward at the rate of a few inches per year, in fact, as it turns out. Now, why then aren't the Himalayas tremendously high by this time? It's been going on for 20 million years or so. Two reasons. First of all, erosion due to that omnipresent liquid water. When rock is low, it is left alone by erosion. The higher it gets, the more it is eroded. And so, same as in human affairs. You stick your neck out and people notice you and you start getting the attacks. In fact, the erosion manages to proceed at almost the same rate as the rock is being thrust upward. Number two, if that did not happen, and usually this is not the dominant point because usually this does happen effectively enough to be the answer all by itself, but number two, if it did happen, what would happen is the crumpled portion, the mountains themselves, would start getting higher and higher and higher until you began to run into the fact that rock in large quantities has no structural strength. And if you tried to pile up rock, if you tried to make a mountain on the earth higher than about 7 miles high, varies with the kind of rock because their strengths vary, but not a whole lot. If you tried to make it higher than about 7 miles high, you would find that the pressure due to the weight of all that overlying rock on the bottom of the mountain, that pressure would become so great that the rock at the bottom would begin to flow sideways like molasses. And thereafter, you could not make your mountain any higher. We had a question over here, or did I answer it? Okay, fine. So this is how mountains form. I think you can see how earthquakes can happen, not only at a strike-slip boundary where two plates are sliding alongside one another, such as the San Andreas Fault, but also imagine subduction. That's not going to be a nice, smooth, steady process either. And so the subduction also is going to occur in a series of jerks, and I don't think you're going to be terribly surprised to learn that these subduction zones, in fact, you know where earthquakes occur, you figured it out already, these subduction zones are major earthquake centers. As a matter of fact, the spreading ridges are also earthquake centers, and again, that's because the spreading goes in a series of jerks, and new material keeps coming up and rudely shoving the old stuff aside. Well, you can make a wonderful map of the plate boundaries by simply taking a few thousand earthquake epicenters and plotting them as dots on a map of the Earth. Indeed, in the early days of plate tectonics, that was how they figured out, and that was how a map like this is drawn. Now, it turns out that there are a few places where it's not quite that simple, but all of your major plate boundaries are locations where there are earthquakes. Most of the earthquake activity on Earth is due to plate motion of one of the three types: spreading, strike slip, or subduction. But not all of it. I want to tell you right away, before I tell you all the wonderful things plate tectonics can explain, that it does not explain all of the geologic activity on the Earth. For example, do you know where the biggest earthquake in the history of the United States happened? It did not happen in California. It did not happen in Nevada. It happened in New Madrid, Missouri, right on the Mississippi River in the year 1813. Fortunately, virtually no one was living there at the time. But that was an earthquake which is estimated as almost 9 Richter magnitude. There has never been an earthquake on the Earth that has quite hit 9. That is estimated at almost 9, and that is several tenths of a magnitude greater than, for example, the famous San Francisco one. There was another earthquake almost as severe there 2 years later. I wonder how many people know that the city of Boston was destroyed by an earthquake 20 years before the American Revolution in 1756. I wonder how many people know that the... Can't remember the name of the city. Major city on the coast of South Carolina, beginning with S. Charleston, beginning with C. Thanks. That's why I couldn't remember. The Charleston, South Carolina, was destroyed by an earthquake in the early 1800s. Now look at where those places are on this map, and you will see they have nothing much to do with plate boundaries. So there are other things that happen for earthquakes besides this, but this explains the majority of the earthquakes that happen on the Earth. In the case of the New Madrid earthquake, we know what caused it, and I'll tell you later. In the case of the Boston and Charleston earthquakes, we do not know very well. There are some theories, but they're tentative enough that I'm not going to bother you with them. And in fact, enough is known about seismic activity in New England that we can tell you that there should be a major earthquake in the San Francisco area on the average about every 50 years, which means we're coming up due for another one. And indeed, stress has been building up alarmingly along that section of the San Andreas Fault ever since the last one. There is almost certainly going to be a major San Francisco earthquake within the next 20 years. When it will happen, I don't know. Of course, you always have nuts that have crazy theories to predict earthquakes, and they're always rewarded because they're always major earthquakes, you know. And so a couple of years ago, it so happened there was a whole series of major earthquakes which happened to be in relatively populated areas by just unfortunate bad statistics. And so you had all the nut theories about why this year had all the earthquakes and, you know, everything from the second coming of Christ on down. And in fact, if they bothered to check, that particular year, 1976, had one fewer than the average number of major earthquakes per year. It just happened by unfortunate statistical luck that they were happening in places like Peking and Guatemala City, rather than out in the middle of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge where nobody's ever going to hear about them because they're not news except to geologists. There should be, as I say, a major earthquake in San Francisco every 50 years. Well, enough is known about seismic activity in New England that we can tell you there should be a major earthquake in Boston about every 250 years. Which means that we are coming due within the next half century, century or so, because that 250 years is only a statistical average, and the number is not known too well anyway. We haven't enough history of observation. But somewhere in the next century or so, there should be another major earthquake in Boston. Nobody in Boston knows this. You know? I mean, everybody in San Francisco, even these turkeys that build their houses on the San Andreas Fault, at least know that they're being stupid. You know, they at least know they're living in an earthquake zone. And there isn't anything like as much building code restriction and restrictions to where you can build cities and so forth. There are insane examples of that. I guess my favorite worst example is a town in California which is built on a sand spit overlying the San Andreas Fault. The entire town. And that whole town is going to simply disappear into the ocean the next time there's a major quake there. And indeed, so is a good part of Boston. A lot of Boston is made land. Boston Bay has about one-third of its natural area left now as water. The remainder is stuff that has been dredged up out of the deep places in the bay, out of original shallow places to make deep places, and piled up so as to make land for people to live on. This seemed like a brilliant combination of solving two problems at once, making deep channels so that you've got a good harbor and creating new land for people to live on. You've got the same thing in San Francisco. San Francisco Bay is now less than half of its original natural size. Okay, the only problem with that is that this material that is dredged up is rich in clay, not surprisingly, for mud on the bottom of a bay. And many of these clays are thixotropic. What that means is that in their molecular structure is water molecules, which are so loosely held by the atomic bonds that if you heat them just a little bit, or if you even shake them strongly, the water comes out as water, and all of a sudden, what seemed to be solid clay turns into a liquid. What do you suppose could shake the clay and the made land in San Francisco and Boston Bay? Right. And that is going to be probably the major cause of loss of life in the next quakes that occur in those places. And there are just no building codes about earthquakes in Boston, because the last quake was more than 200 years ago, and that is too long for human memories to get into the law books. Question back there.
Yeah. When the Atlantic River scandal went up there.
Yes.
Presumably there was no cropped water overlying what came from.
At the very beginning, you must not have had water in the crack, but it would have flowed in very quickly, and I will show you an example of where precisely that... correct.
When now the ship departs, the outer 100 miles, whatever it is, 200 miles of continent...
What is now the continental shelves, right? Was then above sea level, correct. Exactly. You figured it out. Furthermore, there was erosion as long as it was above sea level, and that erosion tended to be preferential at the edges, because that's where the water was going over the edge into the ocean. Of course, that's complex, because you also had deposition there as soon as it got under sea level, and so you have the continental shelf sediment. But you've hit the main point, and that is that as the two continents, the edges of the continents, moved away from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, they have been slowly sinking. The reason for that I will talk about in the final lecture in this series, which is 2 weeks from now, a Skylab tour of the United States Part 1, which, although it will be independently understandable of this one, it really will have helped to go to this one to, you know, get the full implications of, because what it is an illustration in detail of the plate tectonics general principles that I'm going to give you tonight. What it is about is primarily a history of the Appalachian Mountains. And so in that lecture, if you come back 2 weeks from now, you will find out why it is that indeed this happens, that the edges of the continents do sink down that way as they move away from the spreading center. Probably not, because the question is that substance related to the earthquake in Boston and Charleston? Probably not. I've asked the same question of geologists who are specialists in those areas, and they say no, because that substance is gentle enough that it just doesn't explain the amount of earthquake activity that you observe on the east coast of the United States. Most of which you see is tiny quakes that even the people that live there don't notice, but you can add up the total energy and it's quite large. So there's more to it than that. I will now state Loudon's Law of Geology. To any generalization in geology may be appended the statement, but it's more complicated than that. Let's go on telling you about some plates. In fact, let's follow up what the gentleman who just asked the question was talking about. Here is a place where you have a new spreading center, that has recently developed is shoving some continental material apart. This is a little more complicated because the direction of the shove is not simply away from the spreading ridge. There is, it's moving away at an angle, but water has begun to flow into it. It's right there. And what they haven't shown on this map is that's a triple junction. There is another spreading ridge which runs down the east edge of Africa. And so you've got this thing that is labeled African plate actually split into two subplates, which are slowly moving away from one another. East Africa is being shoved away from the remainder of Africa, and the time will come when water fills in what is now a huge trough down the middle of dry land, and that, as any of you who know African geology have already figured, geography have already figured out, is the Great East African Rift Valley. Most of that has no water in it yet, but the lowest areas have the string of lakes, which you can see on a map of Africa, Lake Victoria, Lake Nyasa, Lake George, and so on, or whatever they call them all this week. You know, every time there's a change in political regime out there, they rename all the geography. And while in principle I subscribe to the general idea that the people who live in a place should be those who determine what we call it, in practice, with African geographic terminology, I figure I'm going to wait until the dust settles. And so, you know, whatever they call those lakes in the East African Rift Valley, the reason that they're there is that that huge trough, the biggest such feature that is still on land on the Earth today, is forming. 200 million years ago, you had one just like that down the middle of Pangaea, except, number one, it was even bigger, and number two, there the motion was almost perpendicular to the trough. In the case of the East African Rift Valley, it's more complicated. It's at an angle to the perpendicular. All right, let's show you now, that's all the general principles. I don't think I've left anything out. And so let's show you a few specific examples. For instance, every place where you have a mountain range, there should be either a subduction zone just offshore, or there should be a place where the two continents are coming together, depending on whether it's a boundary between a continent with a mountain range on it and an ocean floor plate being subducted under it, as you have along here, and so now you know why the Andes are there, or a place where two continents are being shoved together, such as the Himalayas, which you've already talked about. Offshore there, wherever there's a subduction zone, and in fact, I shouldn't just say offshore, here's a subduction zone where basalt is going under granite, here's a subduction zone where basalt is going under basalt. In either such case, you've got a big slab of rock going under another big slab of rock, and I think you can see there is going to be a trough created along the edge, right? Those are the undersea troughs, and those are the deepest places in the world's oceans. And now you understand what must have seemed like a paradox to you ever since you began to learn any geography, and that is why mountain ranges tend not to, the highest places in continents, tend not to be in the middle of the continent with a gradual slope down to the sea from there, and why the deepest places in the oceans tend not to be in the middle of the oceans with a gradual rise up from there. Rather, mountain ranges tend to be along edges of continents, because that is where the action is. And the deepest places in the ocean are very often along the edges of continents, or else sometimes they're in the middle of the oceans. It depends on whether you have basalt going under basalt or basalt going under granite you've got there. So you have this strange seeming case of South America with its highest mountains along one edge, the Andes, and then right offshore, one of the very deepest regions of the Pacific Ocean, the Perucelli Trench. That's the reason for it. The subduction of the Nazca Plate under the western edge of the oncoming South American Plate. All right, the Marianas Trench, which is the deepest plate in all of the oceans, the Challenger depth, 7 miles below sea level, 2 more miles than Mount Everest peak is above sea level, are due to the subduction of a small plate, a mini plate, the subduction of the Pacific Plate under a small plate, a mini plate, the Philippine Plate. There are other plates not shown on this map, other mini plates that are not shown on this map. Be warned about that. Plates come in all sizes. An example of a big plate is the American plate that we live on. An example of a small plate is the island of Crete, which is a plate all by itself. Italy is a plate. It's not shown there, but it is. What's happened is, there has been a relative motion of the African plate up into Europe. This doesn't answer your question yet about Africa. I said relative, all right? And Italy at one time was out there in the middle of what was once a much, much wider ocean, of which it's called the Tethys Sea after the Greek god of the sea, and the Mediterranean Sea is the remnant of the Tethys Ocean. All right? There is an example of an ocean which is closing up so fast that it's almost gone. Give another few tens of millions of years, it won't be there anymore. And Italy got caught in between and jammed up into Europe, and that's what produced the Alps. Okay? Look now over the map. Remember where the world's oceans, where the world's great mountain ranges are, and I think you will suddenly understand why many of them are there. But there are exceptions. How about the Appalachians? Yes, the Appalachians are along the edge of a continent, but that is not a plate boundary. The North American plate oceanic portion is not being subducted underneath the continental granitic portion. So why are the Appalachians there? Answer, because there was a time when indeed such subduction did occur. There is an example of a now extinct, once active plate boundary. How about the Urals? Right smack in the middle of what is, after all, one continent, although we insist on calling it two, Europe and Asia. Well, as a matter of fact, once upon a time, those were two separate continents with an ocean in between them, and they got jammed into one another in the same way as India is now being jammed into Asia, and the same thing happened as is going to happen to India. Eventually, the two continents got it through their thick heads that they couldn't move towards one another any further, and so they relaxed. And you have the mountain range that they had built up to that time running down the middle. So Europe and Asia really were one, two separate continents. How about the Ozark Mountains down here? Answer, they're not mountains. The so-called Ozark Mountains do not show any sign of crumpling, which is the true origin of a mountain range on Earth. The so-called Ozark Mountains are in fact a plateau which has been lifted gently with only very, very minor, very local, on a global scale, I would say, with no crumpling or breakage, lifted up, and therefore erosion got at it. Erosion ate down into the once level surface of that plateau. It was level only when it was at sea level. It's not as though it's uplifted first and then the erosion happens. They happen simultaneously. And so most of the Ozark Plateau has gotten eaten away, and where the streams are, those got widened out into the low areas behind the remnants of this plateau, which are what the people that live there call mountains. Now you go down into the Ozark, and yeah, sure, it'll seem very mountainous to you, and you hike over them, and you won't know the difference. But look at the rock. Exposed in road cuts, exposed in stream valleys. You don't see the folding and crumpling that you see when you drive through the Appalachians. You see flat, horizontal, undisturbed strata, which suddenly come to an edge where the whole pile has been eaten away at the edge of the quote mountain end quote. Okay, let's take somebody that hasn't asked a question first. Gentleman back there in the white. The Washita Mountains, boy, that's amazing. Very few people know about them. The Washita Mountains have the same origin as the Appalachians, and you will hear about that in detail next time. Yeah. Gentlemen here. They are caused by what once was a subduction zone. Once upon a time, the Atlantic Ocean was closing, not opening. And so the continent was being thrust over the floor of the ocean, or the floor of the ocean was being thrust under the continent, whichever way you want to look at it, and that was causing crumpling, and presumably there was an offshore trench as well. Exactly. There are many oceanic plates that have completely disappeared. And here is another of the big differences between oceanic lithosphere and continental lithosphere. Oceanic lithosphere, since it can be subducted, can be subducted so that an entire plate is gone. The Nazca plate will have that happen to it if South America goes far enough, and there is evidence. Take a look at the plate boundary, the East Pacific Rise, which runs right up the Gulf of California, and then what happens? Well, then what happens may be that the Pacific Rise itself has been subducted underneath the continent, and it may be that it comes out here to form this spreading ridge, which is the edge of a little mini plate of oceanic material, almost completely gone now. See the subduction zone there from about Northern California up to north end of Vancouver Island, okay? See how there must be a plate that is over on the other edge of that has almost completely been destroyed under North America now? And the chances are that there are a number of plates that have been destroyed under North America just within the last 200 million years, oceanic plates entirely, as North America got thrust away from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. But continents cannot have that happen to them. You cannot ever subduct a continent, therefore you cannot destroy it. The result of this is extremely dramatic when you look at the ages of rocks on the Earth. There is not a single rock on the bottom of the ocean anywhere in the world that is older than 200 million years, 2/10 of 1 billion years. The age of the Earth is 4.6 billion years. In the centers of the continents are where you find the oldest rocks. A continent has a structure, in general, of at least one, typically two, crumpled edges on opposite sides and an undisturbed, still flat-lying center, all right? In those undisturbed, flat-lying centers, you find the oldest rocks on the Earth, and the oldest rocks currently known are 3.8 billion years old, whereas the oldest rocks known on the centers on the bottoms of the oceans are 0.2 billion years old. All right? Finally, let me tell you what may be happening as a result of our having subducted these specific rocks. I don't know how familiar you are with the geologic structure of Western North America, but there is not just one range of mountains there. There's a whole series of them, one after another. There are the Rockies, but that's a third of the way through the continent. Indeed, one of the unsolved problems of plate tectonics at the moment is exactly how the Rockies formed. The suspicion is, once upon a time, these were two separate continents, and they came together and upthrust not the Rockies themselves, but distant ancestors of the Rockies, because there is a tendency for mountains to form at a particular place and then get eroded completely away, and then a new set to form there again when conditions are suitable. The Appalachians have gone through such a history, so have the Rockies. There were ancestral Rockies in roughly the same place several hundred million years ago. Our Rockies formed only 65 million years ago. But then as you go over to the west, you go through a region of low parallel ranges with valleys between them, which are called basins. And they're called basins because, well, that's a detail. There are valleys in between. And then you hit another range of mountains, which are the Sierras in the south, and the Cascade Range in the north, but it's all one line. As a matter of fact, that place where the spreading ridge comes out again from under the continent, if that is indeed the same spreading ridge that got subducted down there, that disappeared under the continent at the north edge of the Gulf of California, that happens to be the boundary between the Sierras and the Cascades, which are called by different names because they are quite different in the kinds of rocks they're made of. Haven't told you about andesitic volcanoes yet, but if you'll remember for a moment, the difference between them is that the Cascades are andesitic volcanoes. The Sierras are a folded mountain range like the Appalachians. They're a crumpled plate. And then you have the Coast Range is still further west. But I want to talk about the Basin and Range Province. The Basin and Range Province is a very strange sort of thing. It is one of the very few places that we know where mountains have formed not because a region of the Earth's crust is being pushed together, one side towards the other, in other words, a compression. It is one of the few places we know where you have mountains because the Earth's crust is being torn apart. Okay? How can that form mountains? Here's how it's happened. A fault is a place where there is a crack in the ground along which there has been motion, vertical, horizontal, or both. Not just a crack in the ground. There's been no motion on the two sides of the crack. It's not called a fault, it's called a joint. The motion, let's talk about vertical motion. You might think that if you take a region of the Earth's crust and pull it apart, or push it together for that matter, that when it cracks, when it fails, if it fails in a cracking mode rather than in a molasses flowing mode, which it will if the force is strong enough and is applied quickly enough in geologic timescales, it'll crack instead of just deforming plastically. You would think the crack would be either parallel to the direction of the force, so that you would get horizontal faults, or they would be perpendicular to it, so you would get faults that were vertical planes, right? That's what your intuition would probably tell you. In fact, it can be shown mathematically that's not the way it's going to happen. The rock is going to fail along planes which are, here's the pulling apart, which are at a 30 or 60 degree angle to the direction of the force, depending on whether the force is pushing apart or pulling together. So the fault plane, if it's undisturbed, the subsequent motion doesn't twist it around. In many cases that's happened, so you can find fault planes sticking at all kinds of angles all over the Earth. But if it's undisturbed, the fault plane is going to be at a 30 degree or 60 degree angle to the horizontal. Now, imagine that you have a place where you're pulling the crust apart. There are a whole bunch of fault planes. If you're pulling it apart east-west, and that's what's happening here in the Basin and Range Province, Nevada is mostly the Basin and Range Province, so let's just say in Nevada, then the cracks are going to form along north-south lines, but they're going to be inclined, and typical pairs of cracks, one next to another, are going to be tilted in opposite directions like this. You know what I need? Lee, could I ask you to do something for me? You asked me if I needed that opaque projector, overhead projector, and I said not. If you can get it for me, it would really help if I could make a drawing at this point, if there happens to be a grease pencil there. Look and see if there is one, and if there's not, then forget it. Is there one?
Yes.
Great. Okay. I do a drawing of this for you, and it'll be very much clearer as to how this can happen, how the Basin and Range Province can happen.
I need to send the motion myself. We can get this. Yeah, this is fine. I just want to make the one drawing. Now, it's in the semi-darkness here. I can find a place to plug it in. There we go, right back. And now, if you have the slide off, and if I can figure out where the crank is, can I figure out, there we go, there we go. Thank you. All right. Here then is what I'm saying is happening. We get faults that are like this, and the motion is like so. Okay? You get a whole series of them, one after another, like this, with the motion being like so.
The tops stay pretty much where the original level of the country was. The bottom, the valleys keep sinking. Okay? Now, can you see how because these are angled to the horizontal and not simply vertical, that you can take up pulling apart of the crust by faulting in this way and letting them see how this whole thing occupies more horizontal thread than it did back when you had that all shoved together? And if you imagine them riding up along those, if you imagine the valleys riding up along those tilted faults, see what I'm getting at?
That's what's happening to the Range Province.
Nevada. Nevada is at least 150 miles wider now than it was before that started. 150 miles wider. Why is the crust spreading there? Maybe because we subducted a spreading ridge and it's still trying to spread under the ground. That happens to be a very controversial suggestion, and there are some geologists who will get very mad at me for telling you about it. But it may have been what happened.
Yes.
Question here. Wouldn't you see some sort of volcanic activity? Nevada is absolutely full of lava flows. You'd be amazed how many lava flows there are in Nevada. Does anybody have any idea where my slide remote control has gotten to?
It looks like it's right, your tape recorder there. No, it's right here next to your table.
Where? Oh, thank you. Okay, let's get on another slide. You've been looking at that one long enough. Here is a summary of the whole process. This is roughly what's happening with South America, but not exactly. We've got the spreading ridge with two basaltic plates moving away from it on either side, and new material coming up from underneath, either to replace that material, if you wish, that's moving away, or that coming up is what's moving away. We don't know which is the cause and which is the effect there. There is a continent riding as a passive passenger on this plate. Here is a subduction zone, which in this picture is shown well offshore from the continent. That's the respect in which it's not like South America. Now, if you look at the geometry, I think you can see that it's not surprising that when you have a basaltic plate being subducted under another plate, it gets shoved down under that plate at an angle, right? That seemed reasonable by just looking at the picture for a second. As it gets shoved down, it is being pushed down into the asthenosphere and getting hotter and hotter, and it begins to melt. It melts in stages. The rock basalt is made of a number of different chemical substances, as most rocks, in fact, are. Usually a rock is not just one single chemical substance. It's a mosaic of grains of different ones. You can see that very dramatically if you look at a piece of granite. If you remember the last chunk of granite you saw, it has a salt and pepper appearance due to these light-colored grains of one kind of material, dark-colored grains of another kind of material. The name for a single one of the chemical substances of which a rock is made is a mineral. And now you finally know the difference between a rock and a mineral. All right? A rock is typically a mosaic of several different minerals. Well, some of those minerals melt at a lower temperature than others. And so as the basaltic plate is shoved down into the asthenosphere, some of those minerals begin to melt right about that far in.